This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon, and this is a very special edition because it's a book special. Snooker is not overburdened, it's got to be said, with books, but three have come out in very short succession. I'm going to talk to the authors of each of them. I'm going to have a general chat about their books and about snooker in general. So I'm going to get them to introduce themselves. I'm going to start, Luke, with your good self.
Evening, everybody. Lovely to be here. I'm Luke Williams. And I've sort of worked on and off in journalism and writing for 20-odd years, although I'm currently a teacher, so I write as a sort of sideline for me. Snooker's been a big passion since I was a kid. And in fact, my first ever book is back in about 2004. And then this year I've returned to snooker writing after mainly doing boxing and football for the last 15 or 20 years. And I've written a book about the hustler and great lost snooker talent Patsy Houlihan called The Natural, which came out in April. And I think that's my fourth book, second snooker book, and I've had two boxing ones as well.
Excellent. We'll get into your book shortly. John, do you want to just tell us about yourself and your book?
Sure. I'm John Skilbeck. I used to report on snooker for the Press Association news agency for quite a lot of years. Churned out lots of copy from the Crucible press room in my time to fill the space in national and regional papers. And my book's called Goody Two Shoes, subtitled How Crucible Anti-Hero Alex Higgins Topped the Class of 82. It's not your ordinary biography of Alex Higgins. It's not a love story to Alex Higgins. It's kind of a deep dive into his finest hour and everything that surrounded that, really. And it's been a joy to write.
Okay, excellent. And finally, Brendan.
Hi there. So my name is Brendan Cooper, and my book is called Deep Pockets, Snooker and the Meaning of Life. My background is, I guess, in academic writing, really. I've written a couple of books before this on poetry of different eras. And having been, and you mentioned, David, that, you know, the snooker hasn't been particularly well served by books. And I guess, you know, writing this, the motivation to write this relates to that, you know, having been a snooker fan since, you know, the age of five, for many years, it has confused me that there is such a paucity of snooker literature out there. And so I guess I was motivated by a desire to write about the history of snooker and the characters of the game, but in a way that is connecting all of that to the world of ideas in various ways.
Excellent. Well, I enjoyed all three books very much, quite genuinely. And the two things in particular, one, they're all really well written, which I like. And two, they're quite niche, which I also really like. And this is a snooker podcast after all. So we're going to get in. Now we're doing this on Zoom. There may be various internet connections that are quicker than others. So if things cut out, whatever, frankly, we're going to have to suck it up. Let's go back to Luke then. So your book is about Patsy Houlihan. And I was thinking about this, Luke. He's a name I've heard about a lot, you know, almost as a figure of myth. His name would come into conversations almost as sort of a secretive character, you know, because he didn't have the career maybe should have had, and we'll get into that. I remember Bill King, Mark's dad, telling me years ago he's the best player I'd ever seen. You know, absolutely certain of that. So what attracted you to someone who is quite a fringe character, I suppose, in the sport?
I think it's a thread actually that runs through a lot of my writing. My two boxing books are also about quite niche characters as well. You know, I'm sort of attracted to these outsiders, underdogs, those sort of characters. I find them more interesting to write about. I'd never really be interested in writing a book about Muhammad Ali or about Ronnie O'Sullivan, you know, people who've been sort of done to death, as it were, or there's a lot of existing literature about them. I like to take someone who's maybe a little bit undiscovered, uncover their story and try and bring them back to wider attention. It's just something I enjoy doing. And I'm all about the niche. I'm all about the niche. And with regards to Patsy himself, I came to Patsy essentially through the fact that I grew up in South London as a massive Jimmy White fan. And I first saw Patsy's name in Jimmy White's 1998 book, I believe, Behind the White Ball. Where he basically says Patsy Houlihan, Charlie Poole and Alex Higgins are the best snooker players he's ever seen. And I hadn't heard of Charlie Poole and I hadn't heard of Patsy Houlihan. And it just got me thinking, you know, who are these obscure characters that Jimmy White idolises? And I started digging into his background back then in 1998. And it just sort of became an obsession. And again, I'm probably quite an obsessive person. Once I start digging and finding out about somebody or something that other people maybe don't know that much about, I'm like a dog with a bone, and I just keep on at it. And I guess the last thing is that I'm attracted to sort of romantic characters in sport. And there's always something a bit romantic about unfulfilled potential, and mavericks who've been overlooked, and people who in the 50s and 60s, when snooker wasn't really have the public profile that it later had, you know, that you know, they could have been contenders, as it were, you know, to misquote probably Marlon Brando. So it's a combination of all of those things that attracted me to Patsy's story over the last two decades, which is sort of how long it's taken to pull it all together.
So briefly, for those who maybe don't know, who was Patsy Houlihan? I mean, he did turn professional eventually, but the point of his story is in his prime, he basically wasn't allowed to.
Yeah, so he was one of the top amateurs of the 50s and 60s, at a time actually when the amateur snooker game was really thriving. There were great many excellent talents, Cliff Wilson, Ron Gross, people like that. And Patsy was reckoned by a lot of judges to be the best of that era. He won the London Championship on seven occasions. He won the English National Championship in 1965. He essentially went through that whole season unbeaten, winning every tournament that was going at the time, beating the likes of Reardon and John Spencer and so on. But the timing just never quite worked out for Patsy. Joe Davis and the other sort of select group of pros in the 50s and 60s sort of controlled the game. And it was a closed shop. There wasn't much money in professional snooker. They didn't want to let anybody else in. Patsy was rebuffed on a couple of occasions, notably in the sort of late 60s, just before the likes of Reardon and Spencer were turning pro. He was turned down. So he missed out on that sort of the start of the new world championship era. Came in the early 70s, by which time he'd served a bit of time in prison. He had issues with his eyes and he was in his 40s and sort of past his peak. So timing-wise, it never worked out for him. And then the other side of Patsy, as well as his amateur accomplishments, is the fact that many people, Bill King, you mentioned as one, many other people I've spoken to, regard him as basically the greatest hustler of all time. You know, the money match circuit in the 50s and 60s, that was the only way to make a living from snooker. And Patsy was the best at that. He went up and down the country, sometimes disguising his play or sometimes not, once he became quite famous in the snooker halls, winning as much money as he could, maybe playing with the wrong hand or with one hand or only being allowed to pot the yellow or not being able to let the cue ball touch the cushion. He developed all these amazing wagers to sort of monetize his talents because he couldn't get into the pros. The only way he could make a living through snooker was through hustling on the money match circuit, which, again, is an area of the game that sort of disappeared these days.
Yeah, I mean, Joe Davis, obviously, the great 15-time world champion, he did, in those early days when there wasn't much of a cake to share, he did rule the game with a rod of iron. And you quote Rex Williams in the book as saying that if you had any sort of nefarious background, you know, you wouldn't be allowed in. But also, I sense it wasn't just that. It was the fact he was good. They didn't like that either.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. He was a threat, you know, and the way the clothes shop operated is, you know, to become a professional, the other professionals had to let you in. And obviously, if they see someone who's younger than them with a great deal of talent, you know, that they're not likely to let them in. So I think his background and the fact he mixed in shady circles on the snooker hall circuit was part of it. But they didn't let anybody in the 50s and 60s, really. I think from Rex Williams in the early 50s until, you know, Spencer, Owen and Reid in the late 60s, there wasn't any new pros for nearly 20 years. So it wasn't just Patsy that was blocked and not encouraged. And really a generation of talent, you know, sort of disappeared from the game. And one of my points behind the book is I wanted to preserve the memory of those players, not just Patsy, but some of those other players as well. And that whole era of snooker, which is often a bit of a footnote or a side note in the sort of major historical books, you know, about the sport. I wanted to bring that era back to life. I felt it was an era that hadn't really been examined in a great deal of detail.
It's interesting, doesn't it? Because again, in mythology, you know, we talk about sign of a misspent youth and we sort of romanticize that subculture a little bit, but it's clear actually there was prejudice against it. I mean, eventually we'll talk about Alex Siggins shortly. I mean, he came from, you know, you could argue the same sort of background in a way. He was sort of let in. You didn't get a chance though, did you, to speak to Patsy before he passed away? So you've spoken to his family, you've spoken to a lot of friends, and you do sort of say at the end to his daughter in the book, you know, you hope to have honored his memory.
Yeah, I spoke to Patsy just once on the telephone very shortly before he died. I had an idea at that point to write a book about the sort of South London snooker subculture with him as a sort of leading character within it. And I'd spoken to Jimmy White and a couple of other people. And I collected together a lot of old billiard player articles, which I sent to Patsy because I found his address in the phone book, which shows you how long ago this was that I was able to open a phone book and find someone's address in it. Sent him this big package of articles and a letter asking if he'd be interviewed by me, followed it up with a phone call. We were in the process of trying to set something up when he died a few months later, sadly. So I never got to meet him. I just spoke to him that one time on the telephone. But I did sort of get contact with his family through that. And yeah, part of my mission to write the book has been, you know, to for them as well, because I'm good friends with his daughter, to provide them with something that sort of honours their dad and that they can have for the future, the future generations of that family, that they know what their grandfather or great grandfather did and that memory is preserved. So it's a sort of, it's a book about preserving a memory and preserving a life that otherwise isn't really documented because there's no real video of him. There's just those, you know, sketchy reports here and there in the billiard player and snooker scene and so on. So I wanted something to be on the record to record what I think was quite a remarkable and interesting life.
Okay, we'll come back to The Natural in due course. And I want to talk about Number One, which is a film I've mentioned many times on this podcast. And Patsy Houlihan's actually in it. So we'll come back to that later. But let's go to you, John, now. Goody Two Shoes. It's a biography of essentially of the 1982 World Championship itself. Why that year, of all years, to write a book about? Why 1982?
So it feels like a bit of a springboard moment, Dave, I think, really. The World Championship moved up from 14 days to 17 days, from 24 players to 32 players. And there'd been some great world champions in the previous years, but no one with sort of the pizzazz of a Higgins. So it seemed like a great opportunity to look at how Higgins had maybe set the tone for the rest of the 80s. Jimmy White was obviously coming through at the same time. He was 20 years old in 82. He'd started winning titles. So he was a sensational character starting to emerge. And there were just all these fascinating characters throughout it. You know, the more I looked at the draw, the more I researched each player in that draw, the more interesting stories I just drew out of it. I mean, obviously, Higgins is the central character to the whole story. But he's far from the only character that I've included in this book. I've gone down quite a few deep dives, really. I spoke to the widow of John Baer, a Canadian snooker player, who's a fascinating character, who's quite similar to Patsy Houlihan, perhaps, really. A player who grew up on the hustling circuit out in Canada, you know, jostling with the likes of Cliff Thorburn. And there were just sensational stories to come out from these sorts of people. And it just struck me as a really interesting time, not just for snooker, but for society as well. There's a lot going on in Sheffield. I mean, you had huge characters in Sheffield in 82. You had Jack Charlton was manager of Sheffield Wednesday. David Blunkett was the mayor of Sheffield at the time, leader of the council. Helen Sharman studying at the University of Sheffield. She'd be going into space in a few years' time after that. And there was just so much to write about. The Human League were enormous in 1982. So the books using sort of 82 World Championship as sort of the central part of the story, but I'll go off in all sorts of wild tangents down all sorts of dark alleys to sort of look at how the UK was in that time, how Sheffield was in that time, how sports in general and where snooker's place in it was at that time. Very different place to where it is now. Obviously, it was a huge television sport back then, as we know. And it was sort of the World Championship where sort of generations clashed as well. There was sort of the 70s generation, but also the generation that would sort of dominate the sport for the next 10 years or so. They were very much coming through into the forefront. And then obviously at the century, you had 25-1 shot, Alex Higgins, who no one was really giving any hope of winning that world title. He was in disarray off the table. He couldn't win it. His friends thought that he couldn't win it. And yet he did. So it's a way to explore how he won that world championship and just sort of put that against UK social history really sort of woven into the story.
I mean, you're definitely right. It was a springboard moment for snooker. I mean, at the time, that the world championship was still the only ranking event. And then the next season, suddenly the calendar started to fill up. And it's also, I think, a more innocent time generally, because you tell the story in the book about the one moment everyone remembers is at the very end after the final, when Alex Higgins beckons his baby daughter, Lauren. But actually, you interviewed Nick Hunter from the BBC, who said that very nearly never made it to air because they were just going to go. They were going to leave.
Absolutely. I mean, they have other shows to broadcast. I think, what was it, the Woman in Wise or the Lady in Wise? It was a big series back in those days. They felt that they had to get that on air rather than wait for any frippery that might happen at the end of the snooker, as some people at the BBC saw it at the time. And then at the same time, there's Nick Hunter fighting to keep it on air. So behind the scenes, this battle was going on, and this just immortal moments in snooker of Alex and Lauren and Lynn as well down on the floor. You know, this moment that we've seen thousands of times replayed, this was almost only seen by 900 people inside the Crucible. They were nearly off air at that time. And that was one of the most interesting stories, really, that came out of all the research, the fact that we nearly missed this moment.
There's a fascinating chapter, a name I think most snooker fans will know, but has completely disappeared, Silvino Francisco. He got to the quarterfinals. You actually tracked him down. Now, that's quite a coup, John. You managed to interview him. I know that, I guess his name, you know, if you're going to look in the phone book, probably not that many, but even so, tell us the story of tracking him down. What sort of fettle is he in?
Yeah, he sounded fine. He'd just been away, I think, been away to the seaside in a caravan for a few weeks. You see, I through a bit of, you know, detective work, I worked out where he probably lived. I didn't have a phone number for him at all. So I took a day trip to the little Derbyshire town where I thought he lived. And I found the streets. I wandered up to his door, knocked on the door, no answer, posted a little note through his letterbox. Hello, Silvino, you know, it'd be lovely to have a chat with you. I just thought, there's no chance of getting Silvino Francisco. I don't think he's spoken to anyone for 25 years in the press, really. And I think after a week or so, I gave up hope practically. Then the phone rang and it's an unknown number. And you think, oh, it's just another junk call, isn't it? We all get these. Presumably it's some insurance scam or something like that. And it turned out to be Silvino. And he was happy to chat and happy to remember those days. I mean, that was probably the peak of his career, really. You know, he reached the quarterfinals that year, furthest he'd ever go at the Crucible. So it's a moment that he was really proud of. So he was really happy to talk about this moment. I know we know that things went sour a bit for Silvino later in his career, and it very much faded away from view, really. But no, that was that was a nice little coup to speak to Silvina. So I've dedicated a specific chapter, as you say, Dave, in the book, just to that brief encounter with a great name from yesteryear.
Well, we'll return to your book, John. I've got a great John Bear story. And if that's not an incentive for keep listening, I don't know what it is. So we'll come back to that. But let's go to Brendan. Deep Pockets is his book. And this is a very different snooker book to one we've ever read before. It's essentially about the snooker, how it relates to the meaning of life itself. So, Brendan, I mean, how long have you been thinking about sort of doing this? I know you write in the book about how you've got sort of childhood connection to snooker. But to what extent has this been sort of germinating in your mind for a while?
I guess ultimately quite a long time. I suppose it depends on what you count as having a sort of clear idea about a book like this. For much of my life, as I mentioned earlier, have been frustrated and confused that there isn't more of a literature, a snooker literature of this kind, you know, that, and I think if you look at any sport or pursuit really, and not just the kind of world major sports, maybe it's in football or tennis or cricket, but even if you look at territory that you might describe as slightly more niche, whether that's something like boxing, which is very popular, but its TV figures certainly tend to be dwarfed by snooker, for instance. Or if you look at something like cycling or even fishing, something like that, what you tend to find is a really rich and expansive library of literature exploring the history and the culture of that sport or pursuit, exploring the ideas that might sort of resonate around it, that kind of thing. And it's just very little of that on snooker. And that absence has been something that's been in my mind for a very long time. I guess the specific sort of focus motivation to actually sort of sit down and write this is something of more recent years. I think I came up with this idea in the abstract 3 or 4 years ago and then put it together over the last couple of years. But the sense that there are books like this that could exist but haven't existed on snooker has been something that has been there in my mind for a long time.
Just to explain to people that each chapter relates to a different subject, which then relates back to snooker. So, for example, the chapter headings: time, disorder, genius, victory, loss, fragility, truth, falsehood, et cetera, et cetera. So did you start by sort of coming up with the different, you know, the different sort of subject matters that you could then relate to snooker? Or how did you approach actually writing the book?
Yeah, I broadly speaking, yeah, I had a handful of ideas that I knew. I wanted to do that. I knew that I wanted a structure which was, you know, chapters that weren't based around, say, or they weren't titled after a particular player or a particular tournament or a particular year or anything like that, but that it was the concept itself that I wanted as the sort of structural basis for each chapter. So I knew I wanted that because that relates to what I was saying about this is the kind of, these kinds of connections are things that I haven't seen before. And I had immediately a sort of handful of particular concepts, mostly the ones that have ended up in the early chapters of the book. And then as I worked on it further, it became clear to me I had approximately 20 ideas. And then I realized, well, if I have 22 ideas, that's one for each ball on a snooker table at the beginning of the frame. And there was a sort of poetic sort of appropriateness to that. And so I worked on it from there. Really, one or two ideas shifted around as I worked on it. It isn't quite right to say that every single chapter is titled after a philosophical principle, but they are ideas based or sort of facets of culture rather than, as I say, rather than sort of named after players. And so you know, they often are dominated by certain players. The chapter on genius, for instance, for unsurprising reasons, focuses mostly on Alex Higgins and then Ronnie O'Sullivan. But I wanted to do that rather than just talk about players who have been talked about a great deal already, to try to look at them from a fresh angle and to think, okay, why is it that this concept of genius, why is it not actually very often used to describe some of the other most successful players in snooker history? Why do we quite rarely see it in relation to Steve Davis or Stephen Hendry? It's not that we never see the word applied to them, but much less often than to Higgins and O'Sullivan. And there are, I think, particular reasons for that, reasons to do with the expectations surrounding what people think genius is and what it requires. Things to do with volatility and unpredictability and a certain kind of volcanic darkness of character as well, in some ways, that that I think means, okay, that fits with a sort of Higgins and O'Sullivan, and it fits with Steve Davis and Stephen Hendry kind of rather less well. So I suppose that that's one example of the kind of approach I was trying to take with each chapter in the book.
We always say about snooker, people love the game, but they also get invested in the personalities because you spend so much time with them, observing them, and everyone has their favourites. And you sort of draw a few parallels with literary figures. There's a lot of literary references in the book. I think it's the only snooker book whose index includes people like Sylvia Plath, for example. We haven't seen that before. So, I mean, I guess it's kind of proof, if you like, that snooker doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's part of culture. And you draw a lot of cultural references towards it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, part of that is playful, and part of it, I think, is a genuine belief that I think this game invites that kind of deeper reflection. And it fits with some of these references that, you know, that it is a game of subtlety and slowness and mystery. And the first chapter of the book is on time. And I, amongst other things, try to reflect on the fact that there's something very important about the slowness of snooker. There's something important in relation to the kind of drama that it can lead to, the sort of drama of the epic narrative, you know, a match that can go on over actually several days. But also it's important in the manner in which it sort of pushes against elements, quite significant elements of contemporary society. You know, we expect everything to be really fast paced and immediate in the contemporary world. And then we have this game when we turn the TV on and it's very, very quiet and very slow, and the audience sits there in silence. And it's possible to switch on the TV and to hear nothing, you know, for maybe up to a minute or so if the commentator isn't actually saying anything. That's a pretty unique phenomenon, I think, in contemporary culture. And there's something very precious about that. There's something, I think, that makes snooker not just unusual, but unique. And so, these are some of the things I was trying to kind of tease out with each chapter.
Excellent. We'll come back to you, Brendan, in due course. Let's go back to Luke now. Luke, the book, of course, is about Pasi Houlihan, but it also, it evokes a certain time and a place, doesn't it? Which you argue in that part of London has kind of disappeared. It's a sort of life that belongs in a way to the past, but you want to keep alive by writing about it.
Yeah, and part of that was the fact that when I started writing the book, I'd actually just left South London. I've lived in Camberwell, southeast sort of inner city London, for all my life. And then during a gap in between lockdowns, myself and my family sort of moved out to the suburbs, sort of down on the fringes of Croydon and Surrey. And I think there was a part of me, you know, that felt I was losing something myself by leaving South London, even though I still work in Camberwell and go back there every day. So I was in a sort of a bit of a nostalgic mood, I guess, you know, making that move and having seen South London change so much over 43 years. And I'm not necessarily saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just the reality of life, you know, that life does change, things do change, things move on. But I think when things do move on, it's also important to respect how things used to be and remember how things used to be. So the only way we can do that sometimes is through writing. You know, that's the only way we can maybe capture things that have gone or people that have gone and keep them alive in some way. And I was also, I don't mention it in the book, but I was a big Woody Allen fan growing up. And there's a quote in his film Another Woman, where the character sort of ponders whether a memory is something that you've lost or whether it's something you still have. And essentially it's a bit of both, isn't it? And that's the sort of one of the key ideas in the book, that Patsy's gone and that world is gone, but we sort of still have it if we can still read about it and talk to people that maybe knew him and preserve, you know, part of that in words. And that's the sort of feeling that I was looking to capture in the book, as much for myself as for anybody else, really.
Well, Woody Allen didn't direct number one, but we must come on to that now, because, as I say, Pat Seeley was in it. Now, I'll say two things about this. Is a film, I've spoken about it before, Bob Geldof plays essentially an Alex Higgins character, 1984, just before, actually, Band-Aid. He wasn't in such great shape, actually, at that point, but anyway, that was the film. I'll say two things about it. One, it's basically no good, but two, if it was on tonight, I would watch it, because I'm slightly obsessed with it. Now, Pat Seeley was in it. You interviewed the writer of the film, who sort of, yeah. His argument was they kind of didn't realize it's supposed to be a comedy, that the people who were making it, yeah. I think.
Yeah. So G.F. Newman, the writer, who's got actually an incredible record in sort of British television and radio drama, he wrote, I think it was called Law and Order in the 70s, which was quite a groundbreaking series. Worked on all sorts of things since. There was a recent, I forgot what it was called, there was a recent sort of epic Radio 4 serial that he wrote as well. A bit like John was saying about Silvino Francisco, you know, in the course of researching this book, one of the things that I really enjoyed was the willingness of people when contacted to sort of talk to you is always heartening. And I think, you know, although G.F. Newman's not from the snooker community are always very welcoming and very keen or happy to talk. And he was another example of somebody, I think I emailed his business website or something, and he'd pretty much almost forgotten he'd even been involved in this bizarre film from the mid-80s, which, yeah, he essentially said he wrote it as a comedy. And Les Blair, who directed it, who's actually a good friend of his, was more of a sort of kitchen sink realist, and they didn't quite get the tone of it right. But, yeah, the film is no good at all. but it's a fascinating sort of museum piece. The cast is incredible. Mm. P.H. Moriarty, who knew Patsy Houlihan on the docks in the 50s and 60s in Deptford. He's the guy that got Patsy on the film. Moriarty also appeared in The Long Good Friday and a lot of other sort of gangster movies. Quite a recognisable face once you know his face. And I chatted to him as well. And again, it was one of those little curios, that those niche curios that I became a bit obsessed with and wanted to bring back to life. And interestingly enough, I did an interview with Paul Ross last week, and he was sort of arguing that it was actually a really good film.
Right.
And so we had a bit of a debate about that.
Well, there's no accounting for taste. Like I say, if it was on tonight, I would definitely watch it. You mentioned there about sort of interviewing people in the game. I get the feeling everyone wanted to talk about Patsy. I mean, Jimmy White has written the foreword, and you mentioned he'd already sort of earmarked Patsy as one of the best plays he'd ever seen. You didn't have any problems sort of getting people to talk about him?
No, you know, quite the opposite. I was quite overwhelmed at times how willing people were to talk. I mean, you know, someone like Steve Davis, who's very busy at the school, a lot of concerns. Again, I think I just approached his agent. They put the offer over to him, and he straight away said yes. And I had my own, who it was a sort of similar story to John's, really. I found, I think, a business dress for him, because he's now in the sort of watch and jewelry trade, apply or anything at all, because I know that Tony's not really had anything to do with the sport for a long time. And yeah, again, very similar to John. I was just sat one afternoon, I think, with my daughters in the garden, and my phone rang. And it was Tony Meo on the phone just saying, oh yeah, I got your letter. I've got no interest in snooker anymore or talking about my career or anything like that. But I really loved Patsy. And he was so kind to me when I was a kid. And I think you're doing something important in sort of, you know, trying to bring his name back and honour his name. So I had to ring you. And that was a great moment, because I think he turned down Gods of Snooker on the BBC, but he would spoke to me about Patsy Houlihan. So that was a great moment for me, I think. That was probably my favourite interview, just because of the unexpected nature of it.
Sure. Thanks, Luke. We'll come back to you shortly. John, well, actually, I remember, John, we were at the World Championship reception, probably when Trump won, and you were writing, you were sort of researching the book at the time, and you said, the one person I'd love to speak to is Tony Knowles, because obviously he beat Steve Davis in the first round, famously 10-1. And literally at that moment, this is no joke, you were there, he walked through the door. Incredible. And one thing we know about Knowlesy, he loves to talk.
Absolutely. Well, he didn't just walk through the door. He walked through the door and sat on our table.
That's right.
Sat on the table. I was like, that's incredible. I think he sat there for 10 minutes chatting away to Stephen Hendry, actually. So he wasn't quite so close to me, but I went over after they'd had their chat, tapped him on the shoulder, Tony, introduced myself. Could have just grabbed 5 minutes outside, and oh, he was accommodating. He was smashing. I didn't really have a list of questions. It was very much Yeah, as we met each other, really, first meeting. I never met Tony before. I don't think he comes to all that many of those World Championship dues, but yeah, he was happy to talk because, you know, 82 in Tony Knowles' mind was all about him. Day one and day two against Steve Davis, you know, what a story that was. And results like Davis losing 10-1 in the first round, it just makes the 82 World Championship, in my view, quite possibly the greatest World Championship of them all. There was that moment. There was obviously Higgins White in the semi-final, that sensational 69 break in that match. But it was sort of a World Championship that was sort of pockmarked by all sorts of great moments, really, and great characters. And Tony was absolutely one of the characters of the day. I mean, you know, he was the guy who ended up being lampooned in Viz. He ended up, you know, on the front cover of the Sun more often than perhaps his mother would wish he was on the front cover of the Sun. And he was smashing that night. He's happy to chat about the good old days with the snooker groupies, etc. And, you know, he's one of, you know, 30-odd people I've interviewed for this book who've been terribly happy to talk about those days, who all got great memories of back in those days. And it's not just an exercise in nostalgia, but I mean, it is in a way, but it's really great history that, you know, without going back through all these people speaking to them again, some of these stories would never have been told. We'd have never known the story about how the Higgins moment at the end of the match was never shown on television. So, you know, I've treated this sort of as an exercise in finding new stories about 82. Even in Higgins' own books, it's only touched upon. There's, you know, two or three pages in each book about him that are specifically about the 82 World Championship. So I figured I'd write 300 pages on it instead. As I say, it's been eye-opening in many ways. I felt like I've gained a better insight into Higgins himself, into that era. I mean, I was about 4 years old at the time, so I vaguely remember the Falklands War happening and going around to my mate's house and seeing the Falklands War on television and thinking, oh, that looks fun. Looks like, you know, without understanding what was going on at the time, I didn't watch snooker until 85, when I think I came downstairs. I think I was poorly that night on the night of the 85 final. So I came downstairs and watched a little bit of the end of the 85 final. That was my first meeting with snooker. So 82 was all new to me. And I think most of these stories that I've turned up, or many of the stories which I've turned up, will be new to readers as well.
Well, people will be at me saying, I promised them a John Bear story. Where is it? So here goes, right? So, this started last year. So Neil Folds, actually, at the Crucible, met a guy outside, one of the autograph hunters. And he had an extraordinary autograph collection. He'd got the autograph of every single player who'd ever played at the Crucible from the first year, 77, to the current time, except for John Bear. Now, John Bear's passed away. So, you know, good luck getting it. He wrote off to John's wife in Canada. Have you got it, a signature anywhere on anything? She had a look, you know, she's very accommodating, didn't have it. So, of course, I mean, talk about, you know, the last piece of the jigsaw. What's the point in collecting all the 200 odd autographs if you've not got, you know, the last remaining one? It was like a personal quest. Anyway, eventually, thanks to eBay, someone actually had specifically, because he only played there in 82, didn't he? They had specifically the program from the 82 World Championship. He had to pay a fortune for it, but he couldn't not get it. So he barely got the program, and all is well. It's a nice, happy ending. That's a very interesting chapter, I think, on John Bear, because he's not a player that, I mean, we think of the Canadians, you think of Cliff, you think of Kirk, Bill Werbeneck, a few others before John Bear. Were you sort of, was that the sort of chapter you enjoyed writing, something that people kind of didn't know that much about?
Yeah, Dave, I built up such a dossier of information about John Bear that I genuinely could have done my Patsy Houlihan book, the equivalent of that, basically. And I went through moments when I thought maybe I should do that rather than doing the Higgins book. So it's quite a long chapter. It was great. I mean, I spoke, as you just mentioned, his wife. I spoke to Carol, his wife, a couple of years ago. She's since passed away, I'm afraid, as well. But she was fantastic. She had all these memories. She didn't go to Sheffield at all. she stayed at home, got the odd phone call from home saying how much he couldn't get behind the English cuisine. just I think, what was it, scones and things like that. He just couldn't get his head around it at all. So that was terrific. She was lovely. And, you know, John was an Indigenous Canadian. He'd sort of suffered racism on his way up. He'd found it really tough to get on tour. And Cliff Thorburn had been hugely helpful in getting John onto tour. And, you know, Cliff really rated John Baer. He thought he was a terrific player. I mean, you know, he'd been beaten by John in various matches before Cliff became, you know, the big shot that we know he is. So he's got huge respect for John. And it was only last year, in fact, they resurrected the Canadian Hall of Fame at Cliff's instigation, and he made sure that John Baer and his brother Jimmy were sort of the first people inducted into that. I don't think he'd been sort of utilized that Hall of Fame for 30 years or so, but Cliff decided these guys, they need to be recognized. And, you know, Jimmy was almost as good a player as John, and John had that one moment when he sort of had his moment in the sun at the Crucible. You won't find much of a record of him anywhere else in terms of what we now call the World Snooker Tour. And that was it. And he lost in the first round, went out to Werbenik in the first round. He barely got any coverage at home whatsoever. But there's always a story. There's always great stories behind these people. And I was just really lucky that I got to speak to Carol, who was just able to fill me in on the life of John Baer, the player. Yep.
I spoke to the guy about the autograph, and I just said, why didn't you just do it yourself? No one would know. But he seemed to think that was the worst thing anyone could ever suggest. Quite rightly. Thanks, John. We'll go back to Brendan. A couple of things actually occurred to me as we were listening to the guys there, Brendan, that relates to your book. I think memory is quite a strong theme in your book, and we talk about sort of keeping memories alive, but also I think you sort of say that you're one of your early memories is the 85 final, but actually you realised you didn't see it live. It was a repeat at Christmas or something.
Yeah, that's right. It's fascinating listening to John talk there about, you know, 80s culture, and it's one of the things that I talk about a bit in the book. My personal memory was exactly what you described, that being sat in the middle of my living room with the climax of the Davis Taylor final on the TV screen, and I know that it was a recording. It was on a VHS, maybe even a Betamax video of that match, but it wasn't the actual live match, because I remember there was a box in the corner of the screen where Davis and Taylor were sort of commenting on it in sort of humorous fashion, and I discovered that there was a Christmas repeat of that final that must have been what I remember watching. But I was 5 years old at the time, and there's obviously something about that match happening in the very heart of the 1980s, as if there was this kind of zenith moment of snooker in the middle of a decade that has been, you know, that was so fated as the kind of summit of this explosion of popularity. But also just thinking about what John was saying about 82 and a lot of people might tend to say that 81 was kind of the beginning of 80s snooker, because it was Steve Davis' first world title. But it was fascinating to hear these sort of reasons why perhaps 1982, for all sorts of alchemical reasons, might be where many of the things, the sort of qualities of 80s snooker were sort of beginning to sort of happen fully. I was thinking just today about, you know, the fact that, you know, millions of cricket fans across the country were sort of patiently sat there waiting for the test match to begin. And thinking about bad weather and the way in which bad weather is so kind of crucial to the British psyche. And it made me reflect on the way in which, you had in the 70s and 80s, something that you have to describe, I think, is very British about the sacramental importance of cozy living room spaces. And people sat there with their, you know, cups of tea and very, very little to choose from, of course, in terms of what was on TV. You know, initially three channels, and then I think it was in 82, interestingly, that Channel 4 was born. And so there's something, I think, about that sort of that alchemy, that coming together of really important facets of British cultural life that are to do with things as really kind of basic and bland and mundane as the fact the weather often isn't very good, and what was happening to snooker at the time that kind of led to this extraordinary kind of flowering of popular and the sort of genuine centrality of snooker to British cultural life in a manner that people just sort of don't. If people haven't been following snooker history very closely, they just don't believe you. They don't believe that snooker was the most popular game in Britain in the 1980s. They don't believe that a snooker player, as Steve Davis comfortably was the highest earning sports person in Britain. Such things sound otherworldly. They sound impossible, but nevertheless, they were true. And so I was just sort of reflecting on some of that just from hearing what elements of what John was saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the biggest audience figures for snooker from the 80s, they're all either on a Sunday, and quite often Sunday afternoon rather than evening, or bank holiday Monday when the World Championship would normally finish. And again, this kind of relates to something you write about in the book. I think this is true of probably most sports, but snooker, so many people relate to their own family, sitting with, in your case, your father watching it. And I remember my nan used to love Steve Davis. And there's a quote in your book from a poet, which I may mangle here, so do pick me up if I do, but it's something like, we look at the world once in childhood, everything else is memory, and that sort of bookends the whole book. Just talk about that quote and why that's important.
Yeah, and that's Louise Gluck, and I use that when I am talking about that memory of being sat in my living room at the age of five, the snooker on, and sort of knowing that my father was present, sort of somewhere at the edge of that room. Although I don't remember that as a sort of visual memory, that's more of just of a sense of things. And I think so much of what becomes important to us in life has its origins in childhood, that this, we sort of encounter for the first time these sort of beauties of the world. And therefore they stay with us. And I think that maybe it's difficult, or it's certainly possible for someone, in their sort of 40s or 50s or 60s to kind of start watching snooker for the first time and fall in love with it in the same way. But I think when it's sort of there from early childhood, it kind of becomes part of your bloodstream. And there's something about the fact that those memories are there, they're still there, however much older you get, and that you associate them, I think, with something that's unique to childhood, and that sense of experiencing the world for the first time. And that's not, it's not quite my earliest memory, you know, watching Steve and Dennis on TV at home, but it's one of my most vivid early memories. And there are obvious connections between that and the fact that I've been such a massive snooker fan, you know, for my whole life since then.
I think maybe younger people don't understand about the Sundays in those days were really long, particularly if the weather was bad. Like you say, there's only four channels. For a long time, there was no live football on a Sunday, which people would find incredible. And there wasn't a lot else, really. So snooker kind of had the world to itself. And it was a sport that had come from a very sort of working-class background that had sanitized itself. It was acceptable to families. It was well-presented. These figures were all different. The players all had different personalities. It was kind of a perfect storm. I just want to ask you, Brendan, you've got some like 20-odd chapters here. Do you have a particular favourite chapter, favourite subject?
Tricky question. I guess the chapters, there are different moods to the different chapters, and some of them are a lot more serious or perhaps darker than others. And you know, there's a chapter on falsehood, for instance, where I talk in detail about match fixing and the history of match fixing in snooker and sport generally. I guess I would say I prefer to look back at the more light-hearted chapters, That felt like an important chapter to write, but chapters like the chapter on music, where I talk about Snooker Loopy and other things as well, such as, you know, Steve Davis's improbable posthumous life as a club DJ, that kind of thing, and the connections there. Chapters that are more playful and fun are ones that I find more enjoyable to reread myself. The chapter on sex will be another perhaps obvious one to mention there. The surprising connections between the world of sex and the world of snooker, some might think. But I suppose those chapters, and there's a chapter on fashion, there's a chapter on naming where I talk about snooker nicknames. These are some of the ones that perhaps are a little bit lighter and more sort of towards playfulness than elsewhere.
Well, the chapter on music, you also talk about the Romford rap, which of course is the ill-fated follow-up to the Snooker Loopy, which was a great hit. And I mean, it's very funny the way you describe Jimmy White, who of course has joined Matchroom and suddenly finds himself embroiled in this appalling video. You describe it, you see his face is a picture of misery, skin somehow even whiter than the all-white suit he'd been forced to wear. You could almost see the street credibility evaporating out of him like steam from a coffee cup. It's not a record many people will look back on with fondness.
No, it's not, and certainly not one that Jimmy White would look back on with fondness. That's for sure. As you say, you know, had just joined Matchroom, and then sort of one of the first things he's asked to do is to be, you know, thrown into that video, which is clearly there was a sort of, you know, an element of hubris, overconfidence, I think, from Barry Hearn, overconfidence for, you know, Snooker Loopy was this very surprising but very successful in a pop hit. I think the Romford rap is one that's best forgotten, both in terms of the tune and in terms of the video, which somehow manages to be even worse, I think, than the song itself.
Brilliant. Okay, well, Luke, I want to talk about titles now of the books. You called yours The Natural. I guess there are a lot of things you could have called it. Why did you go with The Natural in the end?
Yeah, there were sort of two reasons for that, really. One is it was a term that Richard Holt, the editor of The Billiard Player, used to describe Patsy very early on in his career, I think in about 53 or 54. And, you know, in connection with what Brendan was talking about earlier about, you know, the sort of snooker geniuses, you know, Houlihan is one of those players who people talk about having been touched by genius. And, you know, many of those tropes that Brendan was talking about are ones that we see in the career and personality of Patsy Houlihan. So I thought it was an apt description of him. It's also a sort of reference to an American novel by Bernard Malamud, whose surname I've possibly mangled and mispronounced, about a baseball player of natural talent who sort of has a downfall. And that was one of my favourite novels when I was growing up. So it's a sort of, it's a nod to Malamud, and it's also a nod to that Richard Holt description. And yeah, hopefully it encapsulates the idea of Houlihan's natural ability and natural shot-making flair, which is what everybody who saw him play speaks about in relation to him. You know, his speed of play, the attacking nature of his play. I mean, there's no documented proof for this, but it's thought he was the first player to score a century in less than 4 minutes, which in those days would have been, you know, utterly sensational. Those are the two main reasons for the title.
Okay, John, now Goody Two Shoes obviously is Adam and the Ants. I mean, it seems an ironic title for a book about a tournament won by Alex Higgins, but you make the point he was kind of on his best behaviour. If, you know, everything's relative, I know, but for him, he was on his best behaviour that year.
Yeah, there's heavy sarcasm in the title, I think, really, to be honest with you, Dave. But no, he did behave himself. I mean, by Alex Higgins standards, he behaved himself during that World Championship. You know, there were moments. I mean, he took a leak into the flower pot late one night after a practice session. He grabbed an electrician by the jumper and ripped the jumper. And there was talk, you know, the Sheffield Star were questioning whether he'd be thrown out of the tournament at one stage. So, I mean, he wasn't really clean living, but he'd kicked heavy booze in for most of that tournament, from what I understand. He drank quite a lot of Mackeson Stout, but I think that was, you know, that was his meal, I think, as much as anything. That was his daily meal for much of his life, heavy stout. So, Yeah, so obviously Goody Two Shoes, the Adam and the Ant single. came out in 1982, came out in May 1982. So it seemed very timely, very sort of the moment, sort of quite evocative of that time. I think it went to number one right to the end of that month, but it was just sort of one of the hits of the moment. And, you know, Alex Higgins, Goody Two Shoes. Well, I mean, he sort of was for 17 days. And, you know, look what came of it. I mean, it didn't happen very often in his life. And this was obviously, you know, it's his second world title, but this was the peak of his career. And it was a slippery slope, really, pretty much from then onwards. Obviously, he won the UK Championship the following year. But it was sort of the beginning of the end of the peak of his career.
Yeah, because what he managed to do in that tournament was hold it all together, which he didn't do maybe at other times. I mean, it's been so many books written about Alex, and I'm sure there'll be many more written about him. Brendan, deep pockets. I mean, apart from being kind of a pun, how did you alight on that?
I guess it goes back to some of the things that we were talking about towards the beginning of this conversation. You know, there's this sense that snooker in ways that I felt hadn't been adequately explored is a game that invites a sort of deeper and more philosophical series of considerations. You know, it's a game with a really long and fascinating history. The game itself, you know, goes back a century and a half, and then several centuries more. When you look at the history of billiards as well, you know, billiards is something you can trace back at least to the 16th century. You know, it's in there's an Edmund Spenser poem that references billiards. Mary Queen of Scots famously was a sort of, you know, such a kind of obsessive billiards fan that she had at a table in her prison cell and so on and so on. So there's all this historical stuff, but there's also, I think, conceptual stuff about the game. Things that relate to, you know, Luke was touching earlier on some of the contradictions in the history of snooker culture. There's that contradiction, say, in the 50s and 60s between the sort of kind of wild, what you might call a sort of wild rock and roll kind of element to the kind of cultures and lives of players versus the fact that actually that was being disapproved of and sort of squeezed out of the game by figures of authority. You know, this is a game, it's a working class game where the players dress up like Victorian aristocrats. It's a game where you have all of this sort of wild behavior and elements of the disreputable, elements of the uncontrolled and self-destructive about, you know, the characters and elements of the history of the game. Then you also have a kind of hyper formality and a sort of ethics of the game and a politeness and the fact that, you know, players own up to their fouls all the time. There's a sort of nobility to the morality of the game and the fact that it's played in this, as we mentioned earlier, this sort of unique silence. So I think the conflicts and the contradictions of snooker are particularly fascinating and part of, I think, what makes it such good territory for this kind of what I broadly describe as sort of philosophical exploration.
Okay, and this is open to anyone who wants to answer it, really. How do you think snooker sort of relates to the culture now? Because the culture has changed. The sort of sleepy Sundays, you know, you can always find something to do. The Sunday trading laws have changed, for example. We have Netflix and things like this now, phones. There's always something you can occupy your time. Snooker, in a way, to me, hasn't really changed. It's the same game. You know, we've experimented with formats, but they still wear the smart clothes. It's still a lot of the tournaments are the same. Has snooker needed to move with the culture, or does it almost transcend it? There's a question to end with.
I certainly, I mean, just briefly, one thing I would say is, because I mentioned it earlier, that there's something about the fact that snooker resists contemporary these elements of contemporary culture that makes it important and makes it precious. But I also think actually that's part of what makes it successful. I feel like there is at times an overemphasis on the idea that snooker in some way, it's not as popular as it was. And obviously in some technical ways, that's true. It's never going to be like what it was in the 1980s again. But you always have millions of people tuning in just in the UK to watch the World Championships, to watch the major championships. Generally, the international support and following for snooker is bigger than ever. And so I think that the timelessness of snooker that you describe, although it sometimes might look to people like in some way a threat to the game, I think actually also is an asset and is something that it sort of feeds an appetite in snooker followers that you don't easily find elsewhere, those sort of longer, slower, more epic narratives. So I would suggest that that's one thing that I feel, and I hope it doesn't really change in a way, you know, where people sort of misunderstand that kind of need to in some way be up with the times. I don't think that would be healthy for the game of snooker personally.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Brendan was saying there, but I guess my main concern about sort of snooker in the modern world, as you might say, it is sort of directly relates to snooker in Britain, which is the sort of gradual decline of the club scene and the amount of snooker clubs that are around. That's something that really concerns me. So, you know, in South London, when I was growing up, you know, there were myriad snooker clubs within, you know, a bus ride of where I lived or a walk of where I live. Now, there's only a couple in South East London. There's one in Catford, there's one in Deptford, and that's pretty much it. And that concerns me. And actually, I did a little event for the Patsy book in his old club or one of his old clubs in Deptford, which is still there. And I was interested to see there were a group of youngsters in the club later on in the day. They were playing on the snooker table, but they were playing pool on the snooker table. And that slightly concerned me. And seeing the growth of the pool tables in that club, Shades, where 5 or 6 years ago there were more snooker tables than pool tables, and now it's about even. And the owner was talking to me that he's considering whether to move out a snooker table and bring in two more pool tables. I think the audience is still there for the game. I think the popularity is still there for the game. But what concerns me is whether the young talent coming through, particularly in the UK, will still be there in the numbers that we want in the next 10 to 20 years, given the sort of slow death of snooker hall culture.
Yeah, I see that absolutely as well. But, you know, at the same time, I think the pace of life in general has just accelerated in the last, you know, 40 years since, you know, the Higgins story. But snooker hasn't, has it? Snooker's just played at the same pace, essentially. It's got the same charms to it that it did 50, 60 years ago. And sometimes we're just looking for that escape. Aren't we? Sometimes we're just looking to sort of slow our lives down a little bit to be able to just sit there and become engrossed in something that, you know, you don't need Twitter for, or you don't need Facebook for. You can turn these things off. You can sit down and you can watch a snooker match for 3-4 hours, and it'd be just the same as it was 40 years ago. And it's that escape, isn't it, really, that I think, you know, we all need from time to time. That's how I see it, really, Dave.
No, completely. And long may that continue. I'll return shortly to sort of a final word, but just a couple of boilerplate things. The first is Rob Walker has very nearly finished his charity cycle ride and run. A lot of people will be aware he's John O'Groats to Land's End. I actually caught up with him last week. You would never know he was doing it. Apart from being slightly unshaven, he didn't look tired. He was the same positive, energetic self that you'd expect. He's going to finish it on Friday. And he's raised nearly 30,000 already. His Just Giving page is still there if you want to donate. Rob's going to finish on Friday. If you want to email the podcast, you can do so, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com, and we're part of the Sports Social Network. They have lots of other great podcasts. To conclude then, people need to know, I guess, where to get these books. John, I don't think yours is quite out yet, is it? But when it is, where can people get it?
Watch this space, Dave, I think, essentially.
Street corners, you'll be handing it out. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you've seen it, that it's essentially complete. It's been further edited since you read it as well. So it's just about ready to go to the printers, to be quite honest. I've got a few little things I need to add. So, watch my Twitter. I'll announce it soon. I would hope late July, August, it's going to be out.
Cool. And Luke, yours has hit the streets.
Yeah, so available from, you know, all the normal online outlets. You can order it from your local bookshop if they don't have a copy. When I was in Sheffield for the semi-finals of the World Championship, Waterstones in Sheffield had some copies, right, as they did of Deep Pockets as well. So, you know, try and support your local bookshop if you can. Or even better, you can hit me up on Twitter, Boxiana Journal, and I can sell you a copy at a slightly bigger price than Amazon, I'm afraid, and post it to you and sign it for you as well. So, yeah, I'm also selling copies myself if anybody wants a personalised one.
you say sign it. I actually sent off a couple of years ago for a Fred Davies book from the, well, I think 1960s or certainly 1970s. And it said it was signed, and it was, but it was signed to someone called Deborah. Obviously, Fred was dead by then, so I wanted to sign it to me. But I just thought it would say Fred Davies, but to Deborah. Anyway, that's a side issue. Brendan, I've got a copy of your book here, so I know it's out. Do we know how it's selling?
I don't have any official data from the publisher yet that I can divulge. So I don't know. I think it's normally a few months before you hear any specifics on that front. But really, yeah, the same story really as what Luke was describing. It's available in, if bookshops don't have it, they will order it in for you, and the usual online outlets. Hachette UK is the UK publisher, so you can certainly find it on their website and order a copy.
Brilliant. Well, I genuinely
very much enjoyed. I bought it at King's Cross Station on the way to the World Championship. They had it in St Pancras. Was it Waterstones? I think so. That was a great read on the way up to Sheffield. I really enjoyed it.
There we are. Look at that. All friends, hands across the water. There. Nice way to finish. As I say, I really enjoyed all three books. And I suppose we talk about snooker kind of being unchanging. You know, people are still reading in huge amounts, which is good to know. And if you're a snooker fan, you'll genuinely enjoy all three of these books and savour them, because, as you say, we're not over sort of blessed with literature in the sport, but these three books, all worth reading. Thank you very much to John, to Brendan and to Luke for coming on and sharing their thoughts about snooker and their particular books. And if I can work out how to stop recording, I will end this podcast. But thank you, gentlemen, for your company. And the podcast will return very soon. And hopefully this is the button to press to stop it. Sports Social Podcast Network.